Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now we'll meet a former partner of Mitt Romney's at Bain Capital, who is also a major donor to a pro-Romney PAC and has written a controversial new book. It's called Unintended Consequences, Why Everything You've Been Told About the Economy is Wrong. Edward Kennard got so wealthy at Bain, he retired at age 51. Maybe you saw Adam Davidson's profile of him in the New York Times Magazine, called The Purpose of Spectacular Wealth, According to a Spectacularly Wealthy Guy. Mr. Kennard, thanks very much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Brian, thank you for having me.
And to establish the relationship first that everyone will be curious about, how close are you with Mitt Romney? I've seen you described in the press as not just former partners, but friends.
I worked with him from 1993. He left Bain Capital in 2000. I left in 2007. So we worked together for a fairly long time, know each other well. We're friends, yes. I'm not a formal advisor to Mitt.
And the number that I've read that you've given about $1 million to a pro-Romney super PAC, how accurate?
Yes, that's public knowledge.
And you left Bain to write this book and establish yourself as kind of a pro-investor public intellectual?
Well, that's one aspect of the book. The book covers the economy much more broadly and has a number of different prescriptions for how to grow the economy, one of which is a long-term prescription, which includes being cautious about lowering the incentives for innovation, yes.
So one of the myths you want to bust is that the financial crisis was caused by making so many home mortgage loans that people couldn't afford. Why do you say that's a myth?
I do think that people believe that the banks were crippled by losses on no-money-down loans, but institutional investors withdrew their deposits from the banking system long before homeowners defaulted, and the losses to homeowners have been substantially smaller than we expected at the time in the crisis when the money was withdrawn. And we've seen this twice before. We really saw it in 1929, and we suffered 10 years of slow growth and high unemployment. We also saw something very similar in the 1990s in Japan, and they had a similar problem. And I believe that if we don't diagnose the problem correctly, we will suffer the same consequences.
But wasn't the run on the banks a secondary result of the big losses that the banks were taking because of these bad bets?
In part, yes, although I think people don't realize that in a securitization, there are subordinated tranches which are approximately the same size, slightly larger than the down payments that homeowners were making, about 20% of the value of real estate, 20 to 30%. So the banking system was, for the most part, protected from a 20% drop in real estate prices. We had a 30% drop in real estate prices, and that caused institutional investors to grow concerned about their deposits and to withdraw them for the sake of safety. Now, we have implicit government guarantees in place that were made explicit during the crisis. And we believe that those implicit guarantees would hold the money in place as it had since 1929. And we woke up the next morning, discovered that they didn't work and probably won't work going forward into the future. And now the economy has to dial down the amount of risk that it takes to compensate for the fact that there's a lot of risk of damage from withdrawals.
But then when you talk about greasing the wheels for innovation and how public policy should grease the wheels for innovation, didn't the growing practice of securitization of mortgages and the illusion of safety created by so-called innovative financial products like credit default swaps and CDOs mean that the real risk of lending got disconnected from the lenders, like Countrywide and others who could make a bad loan and sell it off their books without worry? And shouldn't we therefore be suspicious of innovation, especially on Wall Street?
I think we should always be leery of any changes. Sure, we want to look at them all carefully. But the economy has a problem which is not going away as a result of innovation or regulation. And that is that we run a large trade deficit. The Chinese are very risk-averse savers. They largely want to buy government-guaranteed debt. That pushes risk-averse savers who would otherwise buy government-guaranteed debt into the private sector. They shorten up the duration of their loans. They want to make short-term loans, not long-term loans, to protect themselves. And we have to put that money back to work if we want to achieve full employment. And so we will always face the problem of we can build a big vault, leave the money sitting on the sidelines. We'll have a much more stable economy, but it'll be smaller, slower growing, and with much higher employment. Or we can do what the banking system was designed to do and what the Federal Reserve was designed to do, which is to get that money out of the vault and put it back into circulation into our economy to fund either consumption or investment, and we can have a faster growing economy with higher unemployment. But there's no getting around that dilemma. We're caught on that whether we have regulation or not.
How about in that regard, and to which one we want to choose as a nation? The J.P. Morgan Chase story in the news today. They didn't like the Volcker Rule limitations on the risks they could take. As it's been reported, they've successfully lobbied for loopholes and then managed to blow $2 billion in the last 6 weeks as a result. If this had gotten much worse, a financial reporter who was on the show last hour said it could have, you know, put all kinds of corporate bonds at risk and caused another run on the banks. Isn't that a sign of undue influence rigging the system if J.P. Morgan Chase could just lobby for those loopholes and win them after the big national debate about the law? And isn't that a sign that the mindset on Wall Street is to go after risk, because the potential for rewards are so great and our country will socialize some of the losses?
I think it's a misinterpretation. Well, let's just – two thoughts. The first is, let's characterize – none of us know exactly what happened at J.P. Morgan, but I do know this. They made about $25 billion pre-tax, which means they're making about $500 million a week. They make that $500 million by taking credit default risk, by making loans and trying to make good loans versus bad loans. So the idea that they could lose $2 billion in 6 weeks – you know, at $500 million a week, 6 weeks, they're making about $3 billion of profit over that period. They lost $2 billion of profits. So put that into context, which is it doesn't really threaten J.P. Morgan. The loss would have to be much, much larger before we threaten. But I think the more important issue is that we should separate what's going on at J.P. Morgan today from what happened in the financial crisis. And it's the inability to separate those two things which is leading, I think, to a misdiagnosis of the financial crisis, which is if one bank fails in isolation, there are many ways to solve that problem because we could always have other banks, for example, come in and buy the assets. That's not what happened in the financial crisis. A 30% drop in real estate prices caused a tremendous withdrawal from the entire banking system, which can occur with a small number of large banks or a large number of small banks, which is exactly what happened in the 1929s. And that withdrawal risk for the FCIC report, the Federal Crisis Inquiry Commission, the withdrawals were $1.5 trillion, despite $15 to $20 trillion of government guarantees. They would have been much larger had the guarantees been smaller. And the losses on subprime finance are going to be in the range, according to the FCIC, of about $300 billion. So the withdrawals were five times bigger, and they could have been much, much bigger. So they're two very different problems. If a bank suffers a loss in isolation from other banks, that is a much easier problem to solve and can be solved in a variety of different ways than when all the money withdraws from the entire banking system.
My guest on WNYC, if you're just joining us, is Edward Kennard, a former managing director of Bain Capital, friend of Mitt Romney, seven-figure donor to a pro-Romney super PAC, and now the author of Unintended Consequences, Why Everything You've Been Told About the Economy Is Wrong. We can take some phone calls for Edward Kennard. Maybe you saw Adam Davidson's profile of him in the New York Times Magazine last week. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Adam Davidson's article emphasized the part of your argument that says income inequality is good for the poor and middle class, not a sign of a system rigged for people at the top. How much do you believe that?
Well, the book makes three recommendations. One of them is a long-term recommendation, and that is that we should be very cautious about lowering the incentives for risk-taking because we've seen Japan and Europe do that, and they have been shockingly unsuccessful in producing the kind of innovation that the United States
has
produced.
But wait, you almost said Germany, and Germany has done that, and Germany has been the stable economy with job growth and a stable middle class, right?
I think if you look at Germany over the long run, the United States has been far more successful than Germany has been. We've put 40 million people to work since the mid-1980s on a base of 100 million people. So we've had a 40% increase in employment. Theirs has probably been in the range of 15%. We've brought 20 million immigrants to our shores. We've given them jobs. We've educated their families. I think if you look at what high-wage economy has done more for the middle class and the working poor than this economy, you won't find one that's even close. And if you look at the wage rates in Germany compared to the United States, there's a lot of complaint about the growth in the wage rate in the United States. It's been as fast, if not faster, than the German wage rate growth. So it's true that they've had success over the last couple of years. There's a lot of Chinese buying Mercedes. I say that a little cavalierly. They've done more than that. But they've had success over the last couple of years, and it looks like that success is slowing down.
But what about the stagnation in this country, which even if you're going to argue that it's not as bad as it is in some other countries, is one of the biggest problems that America faces today. I think you'll agree. You criticize the idea of redistribution of wealth, meaning taking from the rich to give to the poor in public programs. But we've had redistribution of wealth in this country for more than 30 years. According to the Congressional Budget Office, income growth since 1979 tripled for the top 1%, while only growing 1% a year for the middle class. You know all these stats about how CEOs used to make maybe 40 times the lowest paid employees. Now it's 400 or whatever the number is. Is this the America you want us to be?
Well, I try to point out that the America today is a very different America than the 1950s because of the nature of the investment opportunities, the unrealized investment opportunities that are available to us. So let's take a quick look at the 1950s. We're, for example, capitalizing on the value of cars. We need an enormous manufacturing industry to do that. We have to pave 1 million miles of roads. We need a worldwide oil industry. We have to build 250 million cars. That's the fleet of cars that are on the road today. Those are enormous capital investments, huge economies of scale. Individuals don't matter much in that economy compared to the large corporations that have to undertake the investments that are available to us. In the 1950s. We saw that economy in the 1970s and 1980s slow down significantly, and we've seen Germany and Japan, who have clung to that economy, slow down significantly. And the U.S. made a transition to a different economy, one where we simply are taking advantage of the opportunities that are available to us. And so today what you see is 13 people and a computer can create Instagram and $1 billion of value in 2 years. And so we have to look at that, I think, as a blessing for our economy, that we need to go down to that gold mine and harvest it.
That's great for the 13 people who created Instagram. I know you also include Apple as an example of that U.S.-based innovation. But where are all the jobs? They're in China for people actually making the Apple products. So that's a concentration of wealth in Steve Jobs and a few other people's hands. Is that really in America's interest?
I think if you get your nose close to the paper and look only at Apple and not the rest of the economy, yes, Apple's created a lot of jobs in China. But the truth is we put 40 million people to work in the United States, way more people than Europe and Japan were able to put to work. And we had near zero unemployment prior to the financial crisis. In fact, we had such a demand for labor in the United States that we pulled 20 million immigrants into our workforce and put them to work. I think it's a little hard to just say because Apple doesn't create jobs, the U.S. economy hasn't created an enormous number of jobs.
But unless those jobs are now seen as the temporary result of a house of cards financial system, which has come tumbling down.
Yeah, I think that the reason why we have high unemployment today is people woke up in 2009 and recognized that implicit government guarantees would not hold short-term deposits in place. And so we have dialed back our risk-taking. Money has sits idle as a result. The economy has contracted. Growth has slowed down. Unemployment has risen. We need to take steps in the short run, which are very different than the long run, where we need to pump up the growth rate with innovation because we see that Europe and Japan have been unable to do that. But we have a very different set of issues in the short run that need to be addressed to put people back to work. Innovation is something that will work slowly over the long run, not over the short run.
Are you not concerned with that redistribution of wealth and how stagnant so much of middle America feels, not just since 2008?
I certainly worry about the slow growth of the United States, the European economy, and the Japanese economy. I think it's hard to believe that the world surplus of labor that's willing to work for a dollar a day doesn't put extraordinary pressure on the high-wage economies. I think it does put pressure on the high-wage economies. I think we have to transition to a service economy. We have been out in front of that relative to Europe and Japan. We see that that's a slow-growing economy, and our only hope for increasing the growth rate back to where we have had since the commercialization of the Internet in 1993 is to continue to harvest that gold mine of investment opportunities that are available to our economy today. And when we look at Europe and Japan, their failure is shocking. We have Apple, eBay, Amazon, Google, Facebook, Intel, Cisco, Adobe. I can't remember all the names. What contribution have they made?
We'll continue for a few more minutes after a break with Edward Kennard, former managing director of Bain Capital and a friend and major supporter of Mitt Romney and his presidential campaign. We'll get a little specific on what the ramifications are of what he is saying for what we should expect from a President Romney, if there is a President Romney. And we'll take some of your phone calls. Thank you all for being patient and waiting on hold to talk to Edward Kennard, author now of the book, Unintended Consequences, Why Everything You've Been Told About the Economy is Wrong. So we'll continue with your calls coming up in just a minute. And then coming after that, Arlie Hochschild today on the collision of home and workplace in her new book, The Outsourced Self. Stay tuned. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Edward Kennard, former managing director of Bain Capital. He's close with Mitt Romney, and his new book is Unintended Consequences, Why Everything You've Been Told About the Economy is Wrong. Sean in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Edward Kennard. Hello. Sean, you there? Sean, it's you. All right, let's try Jim in Manalapan. Jim, you're on the air.
Hello. I was just wanted to ask regarding, you know, there's so much liquidity in the in the economy now. The Fed is basically zero interest rates and so much free money, if you will, but still the banks aren't lending to individuals and small businesses that need it. So how is that addressed?
Mr. Kennard?
Yeah, I think that's the central problem, which is the economy has woken up the day after the financial crisis and recognized that we need to leave a lot of money sitting idle unused to protect ourselves from withdrawals. And so the Fed lowers the interest rate to near zero. They dare anybody to use hair-triggered short-term debt as if nobody learned their lesson. And no surprise that the economy doesn't grow as a result. That's not going to put the money back to work and get our employment back up again. And so I think it's a misguided strategy that simply is not going to work.
John in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, John.
Hi. I kind of would like your guest to step back for a minute, and I think he doesn't take the German example nearly seriously enough. I go over there. I spend about 6 weeks a year over there. I have family members, and the system is much more equal. People live a much better lifestyle. There's a lot less stress. You can earn a relatively small wage and live basically a modest middle class lifestyle because of all the benefits and the safety nets and stuff. Now there is the Germans sort of did this rejigging where they increased the pressure on the workers to work more, produce more, not get quite as many benefits in the beginning of this century. And that has worked. I think they still need to do more of that because you hear a lot from business people that they're restricted and they have problems, there's too much regulation, too much taxing. But the U.S. has gone completely the opposite direction. I'm a small business person out here in Brooklyn, and we are being destroyed. Illegal immigration is basically creating a race to the bottom, both for the employers and the employees. It's destroying the American working class. When I talk to my parents, who come from very upper middle class background, and their friends, they're appalled. They're totally appalled at what's happened to this country. And they are mostly tend to be conservative Republicans, and they are just, they can't believe what's going on. The wealth differential. Now, what your guest is addressing in terms of, economic capital gains at the high level, that's maybe well and good. but what's going on at the regular street, the country is being totally hollowed out.
Mr. Kennard, you hear the concern? Small business owner. Conservative family.
I think if you look at the distribution of wages around the median, it hasn't changed much. I know that there's a lot of fear that we're hollowing out the middle and we're going to end up with two sides. You don't see it in the numbers. I think if you look at Germany, they lowered wages and government benefits in Germany to try to get Germany to grow, become more competitive. The median wage rate in the U.S. has been at worst the same as Germany and, depending on the time frame, significantly better over the last 20 years. And I think that Germany has been very slow to transition from a manufacturing economy to a service economy. And I tell you that I would be concerned if I was Germany over the long run, because you have to compete in the in manufacturing at a dollar an hour wages. The way you do that is enormously high productivity that doesn't put many workers to work. I think they have a pretty tough outlook going forward. I think most economists predict significantly faster growth in the United States than in Germany.
If you don't think that we're hollowing out the middle and you don't accept that set of statistics or perceptions, how about the story in the news over the weekend that 94% of graduates with bachelor's degrees in this country now have student debt? Many of them have massive amounts of student debt. This is because states and the federal government are disinvesting in higher education, shifting the cost to the families. While you argue, I imagine that you argue, that the government should not invest in more Pell Grants, more direct aid to students, so that if we have a ship the low-skilled jobs overseas and focus on the high-skilled jobs economy in this country, that there shouldn't be more government investment in this. I don't know that you're going to say that, but is that the America you want us to be? It seems like new grads are becoming indentured servants to the banks.
I think if you read the book, you'll see that I see a role for government, to be sure, and quite a significant role for government the proposals that I lay out. But I'm not an expert on colleges. I would tell you this, that the government is willing to loan students a lot of money for their college. And guess what? College costs as much as the government is willing to loan students. So if you loan them $500,000, college is going to go to $500,000, and kids are going to be $500,000 in debt. So I think there are unintended consequences in what the government is doing in the area of education. I think that if you look at the employment rate of young people in the United States, now, obviously, we have much more unemployment as a result of the financial crisis. But even today, and even more so if you go before the financial crisis, our employment rates have been substantially higher than Europe's employment rates. If anything, they're eating their young. It's the strongest indication that while one of your callers was saying that Germany has a more relaxed attitude, yeah, it's a more relaxed attitude leading up to 2007 with a lot more unemployment, especially among young people who are starting off their careers. It's not a place where I'd want to start my career.
Are you actually arguing that the price of college tuition is being set based on the amount of government aid that there is, and college would actually be cheaper if government pulled out of that market?
I would think it would be cheaper, yes. Yes. It doesn't change the fact that we'd have this problem of how are students going to afford, because we want anybody who has the capability of getting an education to be able to get an education. That makes America stronger. That makes America more competitiveness. But do I think that it drives up the price of education? Sure. And if we limited it and said we'll give students $250,000 or $150,000, colleges would adjust to get that money. Yes, I believe that's true.
But aid has been going down and tuition is going up.
I don't know the numbers. The numbers I saw looked like student loans had gone up significantly.
Last thing, Adam Davidson's profile of you in the Times Magazine said you had a mean streak and that you demanded or you demeaned anyone not pursuing your kind of path as art history majors, and that you used art history majors as a slur. What was that about?
Sure. The book has a moral component to it. It says that talented people have an obligation to get the training that's required to produce innovation and that they need to take the risks that are necessary to produce it. And so I was drawing a contrast. What I see in the world is a surplus in the United States, a surplus of people with the talent and a shortage of people who are willing to get the training and put that talent to work by taking the risks that are necessary to innovate. And so he was baiting me there, but I was trying to make a moral point, which is we have to step up and make a bigger and bigger contribution if we have the talent to do it. We don't get to simply be art history majors for the sake of our own satisfaction. He described that as a soulless world, a material world. But I think if you're living on $1.25 $1.25 a day in the rest of the world, what you're looking for is the talented people to step up and make bigger and bigger contributions.
Aren't some of the most talented innovators like Steve Jobs people who didn't follow the straight and narrow path?
Sure, but they followed the straight and narrow path for 40 years as well.
Edward Kennard, former managing director of Bain Capital. His new book is called Unintended Consequences, Why Everything You've Been Told About the Economy is Wrong. I just want to give you a chance to say, going out the door, how much people should think that Mitt Romney agrees with you on all the things that you have said here today, being a friend and such a major donor to his campaign. Should we assume that it's Edward Kennard kind of economic policies that we would get from a President Mitt Romney?
No. I speak for myself. I don't speak for Mitt. I think that at the highest level, Mitt agrees that innovation and rewards for risk-taking are essential to growing the economy as fast as it can grow. I think that the book covers a lot of ground. It's controversial ground. It's counterintuitive ground. It's provocative ground. There's nobody who agrees with all the book except for me. And I think you'll find that you'll be surprised when you read the book that this whole issue of innovation and income inequality is a very small part of the book compared to other short-term proposals that I think are critical to get the economy growing again. And I don't know whether he agrees with those proposals or not.
Unintended Consequences, Why Everything You've Been Told About the Economy is Wrong. Edward Kennard, thank you very much for having the conversation with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Brian.